Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and here with me from 1969 is Rob Zombie of Fishing Out of Michael Kester.
That's me. Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to definitely call you out about that with one of the movies today. But hey, we tried a brand new thing last time on the show,
mm-hmm.
which was we practiced for 498 shows, and then we did a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should do another good one.
Okay.
I was thinking maybe we'll give it another 500 shows, but...
Sure.
Fuck it. Let's do the second good one in a row.
Okay,
what do you say?
No, I'm down with that. Yeah.
How did we do that?
It opens like this. Today we're covering a couple. It's interesting. So even in describing these movies,
no, I didn't.
Even in describing these movies, it's interesting because I hesitated to say we're covering a couple of films. And that's a big part of what I want to talk about with these two things today. I'm going to argue that they are films. And it's definitely... So we've had a rash all year of let's see what weird shit Michael can put on the show without permission. Uh-huh. And I think I jumped the shark on this one a little bit.
We're better off for it.
If you want to get back to regularly scheduled normal amounts of weirdness... patreon.com/double feature. That's where you can go to suggest movies that are like 20% as weird as these. And we'll totally cover them.
We've
and we'll credit Ross for everything. It doesn't even matter.
It does matter. Hey, happy 500th, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Congrats on that. So yeah, we got the backlog of, you know, the other 500 episodes on there.
499, don't exaggerate.
I wanted to, yeah, good point. Also locked away in that giant double feature cloud thing that's on the Patreon.
Were you going to talk about additional content?
I was going to talk about additional content.
Hell yeah, additional content.
So we're on, if we had been doing this correctly, we'd be on episode 50 of our other show,
mm-hmm.
additional content. But I think we're on, you know, I don't know, 42 and a half or something mm-hmm. over there.
Sure.
But point is there's a bunch of them and they're wicked good. But we're not constrained with the format of, hey, do these two films. Sometimes it's super loose. Sometimes it's, hey, do these nine films.
Sometimes it's, hey, do these five films. No, I don't want to. I'll do three.
Yeah. Sometimes there's a barter system we work out with the audience. Although I'd like to point out that anytime that's happened, I go back and I go, guys, are you really sure we should do five? And they go, or just don't do anything. I don't care.
Yeah, that's true.
What does any of this matter? That's what they do.
As long as we don't poke the bear with Charles and his shark idea. I feel like he will double down on that if we're not careful.
Charles, by the way, who goes, I don't like these free floaty shows. And then 2 weeks later goes, hey, that free floaty show you do is like one of your best shows. Sounds really good. Job.
We're not supposed to make jokes people don't understand.
I want to do a free floaty non-movie centric show that's actually about the best movies for the additional content. How would you feel about that?
I can come up with the best movies.
I know that's very film critic-y of us, and we usually avoid, you know, listicles and those type of things, but I think it might be worth it. Look,
you're just excited because you saw some of them. That's it. That's this conversation in
a
nutshell. You saw six movies last
year
and you have a conversation now.
Yeah. And three of them weren't on the show yet. That's what's happened. No, I mean, you know, there's been this bigger conversation on film Twitter. Fuck you, film Twitter, for secretly executive producing our show, shadow producing it. But about, hey, leave your negative fucking take to yourself, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Your Razzies and your I hate movies. Your Michael and Eric, I hate movies,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is in another universe, the actually popular version of this show.
Sure.
It's just two movies that suck.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone would subscribe. And after 500 episodes, still going strong on not doing that. So I was going to make a joke about
after 448 episodes.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, that's some bumps to work out. But Anyways, my point was, it's also been sort of illustrated that the best way to do that is not even to spend so much time decrying the Razzies, although I think there's still plenty of time for that, but just to talk about the best movies then. You saw a good movie, people want to know about it, fucking talk about them. And yeah, it's a little listicle-y, but fuck it. I want to talk about some good movies we saw. And after all of these years, we've finally realized that we're not going to be able to do a show on every movie ever made.
It's just oh my God. Happen. I don't want to get to that yet because you wouldn't realize it when we're covering Industrial Symphony number 1 and Lucifer Rising. You definitely get to the point here and be like, wow, okay, so these are the last two, I guess. We've seen everything else.
It does feel like that sometimes. It does feel like we have literally covered all the other movies. Anyways, so there should be an additional content episode out using the transitive properties of podcast magic, probably before I even said that to you just now. We'll already have done. Unless it's 5 days late, wherever this falls on the calendar, where it's like, it comes out, additional content comes out in the first week of the month. So we're pretty good about that, at least. But it's funnier if we say it comes out on the first, because that's literally never happened. So, in fact, on the site, I list all the dates as the first, even though I know.
Yeah.
I know that's never happened.
Before we jump into the David Lynch movie, if you haven't seen it and you don't want to get spoiled, about halfway through the show, we're going to start spoiling the other one?
Yeah, I guess.
So, anyway, Are we Industrial Symphony number 1 ready?
One of the problems we have looking back on these Lynch movies is usually we're pretty good about this, but I have found that for some strange reason, we seem to have fucked up. Try and do these Lynch movies like every 50 shows or whatever, or we have been for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But we fucked up if we do the Lynch movie first or second. I don't think we have adhered to that.
Cool.
I think we might have fucked it up like twice.
Cool. So then it's completely, it doesn't matter, right? This says number one. Just, I feel like it goes first.
Okay. That was patreon.com/double feature in case I forgot to actually say the thing. Since we're doing good episodes now, I felt like I had to clean that up a little bit there. Yeah. The subtitle of this, or whatever it's called after the colon, the post colon on this is The Dream of the Brokenhearted.
There we go. So one of the things that I really want to, and I'm just going to get into it off the bat with these two movies, is one of these is a very broad question and it has a very easy answer. And the other is a very easy question and has a broad answer. The first is, what is art? And the second is, are these movies? I think looking at, this is the most experimental I've ever snuck into double feature. David Lynch has made it easy for us for a long time to get into kind of ethereal ideologies and aesthetics in film and
transcendental meditation.
Sure. Well, and just the basic idea of narratives being secondary, tertiary, or completely non-existent.
Optional.
And us being able to still strongly, because of the giant player that is David Lynch, be able to go, nope, these are movies. Nope, this is fine. So I wanted to accept the challenge of this following an Inland Empire show where it's interesting. We've talked about this a few times with David Lynch, that a lot of times his work, especially, I know Blue Velvet is a good example of this. He starts in a place that a lot of filmmakers and writers specifically don't start, which is with a feeling.
Yeah.
He tends to create things with the desired result of, I want people to feel a certain way, and not necessarily, I want people to think about this human experience. The thing, do you remember last week you mentioned the empathy machine?
Sure.
I feel like we may be dabbling in an area of film that doesn't quite function the same way, but I think it's still strongly relevant. Because you're not identifying.
I don't think I disagree with you, but yeah. I would say that you could make an argument that his movies are nothing but empathy machines.
Right. Well, that's
I want to put a feeling in a box. How are you going to do that? I don't know.
I think
it's definitely going to be in there.
I think my point there is to mention that you don't watch either of these movies today and identify with them.
Yeah. Empathy is a good, yeah. I think about it as just putting a feeling in a box.
Sure.
I think about it as the poor man's version of the Ebert phrase.
Yeah.
Well, because there is this traditional idea, and I think there's a lot of what you're getting at too, to look at what other films do, is people talk about telling stories. We talked about that on a lot on the last episode, was, you know, you want to tell these stories, and people really, really push that, especially at a script writing level, which is probably the best place for it. But even just in conversations with filmmakers, you know, what was it that led you to tell this person's story? Why did this person's story need to get told? Why do we need to follow? And we sort of forget that there's also this other option, which is simply to make people feel, to make people question. It doesn't always have to be. I think the most surface thing you can say about a film is it's entertainment. And then as you get a little deeper, you start to go, well, okay, storytelling. But I don't feel like in the strictest sense, you can call anything storytelling, but in the strictest sense, a film even has to be storytelling. I think it can simply be provocation of some kind, whether that is to question things philosophically, to question the form, to question what is art, simply to not provoke and then ask people, just because you're standing there staring at this 16x9 box, did you expect that I had to provoke you? I mean, you know, that is the nature of experimental film, is to go, I disagree with your very premise of how do we tell this person's story?
Yeah. I think both of these films, but this movie especially, is incredibly reactionary. Or maybe I mean reactive, or maybe I mean a different word that I can't quite place. It's a movie that you watch, and then I feel like in a perfect world, David Lynch comes out from behind the screen when it finishes and says, "Did you feel that?"
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
But the other thing too that I think the most Lynchian thing about this movie is I feel like David Lynch is sitting in the theater at the completion of this performance going, yep, that was perfect. Got everything across.
Yeah, right. That did everything I wanted to. Have you read his book? I haven't read his book.
No, I have not.
Yeah, I have to do that before we
different
talk
podcast
Lynch anymore on this show. Well, just the kind of insight. I mean, the more I learn about filmmakers, the more I learn everyone's riddled with self-doubt and doesn't know if they accomplish literally fucking anything they set out to do. Now that you've mentioned that, though, I have a real hard time imagining the moments where David Lynch goes like, did I get it yet?
Yeah.
Is this working? I just can't.
Sure.
See, not to like, oh, say everything is perfect or he misses the mark or anything like that. I guess I mean nothing more deep than I just can't fucking imagine the guy going like, are we getting it here?
Yeah.
What does it look like when he wants to do a second take?
Right.
Like, what is
sure. Well, I think what's also really interesting too is you look at the performances in this thing and even we've done 500 fucking shows, and this movie might be in the top acting performances of anything we've covered, because nobody seems to think it's fucking weird.
Yeah. I wondered about that.
Like the woman singing, sure. Like she's got a pretty cut and dry thing, but I mean, Michael Anderson fucking kills his monologue. Like what the fuck is that?
He also kills his sawing a log.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's a duologue. Trying to turn a monologue into a duologue.
Oh, so many good log puns. It's so rare that you get this degree of log puns.
No, but when he does his little noir with the woman's voice and everything, It's, God, I mean,
I know
it's
on the call sheet. It says day player / day laborer, Michael Anderson. So that is reflective. This is my first time seeing this. I actually didn't even fucking know this existed until you mentioned it, which good on you. In today's age, when you could show me a David Lynch thing I didn't know existed, I feel pretty good about that. But I think that echoes, if not repeats verbatim, the opening of the movie, right?
Which the, is, yeah, the from Cajun, the like weird, wild yeah. at heart cutting room floor bit. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you did there, production values. I know when we got that piece. Actually, top of the I don't credit. Know. I don't know, because the other thing I loved about this is, you know, 1990 David Lynch. David Lynch has warped a lot in our minds, and that was part of the great experiment of Twin Peaks coming back, is everybody has this like simplistic idea of exactly, it's so funny to gauge people's reactions to old David Lynch movies, because everybody tries to wrap them in some kind of narrative or some kind of, you know, I think about the Mondo Mulholland Drive picture that's a Mobius strip. Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, one of my favorite pieces of Kevin did that. I forget Kevin's last name, but
Durant.
No.
That was a last show joke.
Oh my God. Anyways, my point was, you know, we go, oh yeah, one of those Mobius strip, you know, Mulholland Drive is a movie that defies any explanation. And then you look at it and you go, no, it's a Mobius strip. That's how you explain it. Move on, next movie. Easy. And Lost Highway is actually the exact same fucking thing. You just go, oh yeah, because it like weaves together, but it's in starter style, you know, Mobius strip. Okay, next movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy. You just fucking move on. And people do that with Twin Peaks. They go, yeah, like Coffee Empire is a mystery. A Lady Has a Log. It's fine. And once we actually revisited Twin Peaks, people kind of went, oh, there's all this fucked up stuff in here that our minds just like couldn't deal with. So we pretended it wasn't in the original Twin Peaks. The fucking like anti-humor quaintness of it, and
a lot of
the Twin Peaks, which may be, let's say, a show for another year, a fire walk for another year. But I loved, you know, revisiting that, and then also to look at this movie for the people who looked at, you know, season 3 of Twin Peaks and went, oh, I don't know, it's so weird, you know, there's a scene where a guy's just sweeping a floor for 15 minutes. Hi, have you seen Industrial Symphony number 1?
Like, right.
This is, watch that movie and then tell me a dude sweeping a floor isn't a linear narrative about telling right? one man's story. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Totally.
But also, to your original point, you can't watch this movie and tell me it's not a David Lynch film.
Right.
Because it just feels quintessential. It almost feels like a stage production of, you know, like someone else putting on David Lynch the film.
Yeah.
You know, this is like... I mean, that's exactly what it's like. It's David Lynch putting on David Lynch, the film. But it covers some of these areas that I feel like we've sort of glossed over in looking at what is the DNA
of absolutely. A David Lynch
movie.
Yeah, it's like deconstructed David Lynch, you know?
Did you get anything while you were watching this that you, because I kind of have one or two in mind, but I don't know if you had stuff where you kind of went, you know, we've never talked about this aspect of David Lynch, but... oh, look, this is a lot of it. Like, one I thought about was musical performances.
Yeah, yeah. Especially like single women with microphone.
Totally.
You know, sort of the like post-flapper 50s jazz club women singing. I mean, there's the Silencio, Club Silencio in Mulholland Drive is kind of like the moment for that for me with the Rebecca Del Rio song.
Yeah.
But this just plays that up so much.
Rammstein and Lost Highway.
Yeah, same thing. No. Same difference.
I don't know if Lost Highway quite... well, Lost Highway might have some of those moments. But also, I mean, the new Twin Peaks has the musical fucking performance of the episode. The Nine Inch Nails music video of the episode. But also, remember fucking Eraserhead?
Yes, I do.
I mean, all the moon face.
Yeah.
Just like there's so much... of that. We've talked about Lynch and sound design before, and I think to some degree Lynch and music, but it's literally the musical performance. It's the act of watching a performer on stage producing live music. And this is an interesting one for him to choose to represent, not only in his films, but then in a film that looks like a stage production, because, you know, the very element of live music that is most interesting is the fact it's fucking live music. So to then tape it and show it to people, sort of like, it definitely subverts that element. But you don't get to see it a lot in film because of that. We don't get to go through that same thing where we kind of study a person as they're delivering, you know, an honest live performance like that, compared to something where it's like a music video or it's pre-taped or they're looking the way they want to look.
Mm-hmm.
Just the more vulnerable, truly the sense of the word live. Truly, I'm delivering this music. It is, you know, you're hearing what's coming out right now. And then also for this movie to then even flip that and film somebody who is on a stage doing live music and then show us the television screen of that.
Right.
Which is kind of like David Lynch's, another one of his fascinations is the creation of film. He is somebody who, you know, he's not one of these people who really seems like they do entire movies about making movies.
Right.
But that is a lot of Mulholland Drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does definitely have an interest in a way that I think a lot of other people don't talk about the industry. You know, he shows this side of, I guess what I mean to say is people tend to write what they know. And so you see probably an overrepresentation of movies about movies, about filmmaking, because once
movies
you make
about
a
Hollywood,
couple,
yeah.
Yeah. You make a couple films or whatever, you're just in that life all the time. And suddenly you're not living the other lives that make you write the other stuff. You're going, wow, I had a weird experience trying to make movies. I'll make a movie about that. You know, that kind of like seeps into your work. And the way that, you know, it almost seems weird to say that David Lynch would do something like that, but that is what Mulholland Drive's about. And that is some of this fascination you see with some of his television programming and with this idea of like filming a performer and then watching that within his film that looks like a stage production, of an interest in how we represent a performer. It was the first time that those things really tied together for me in a way I could think about them. The live elements of how something live is different than something, you know, how a stage play that you're seeing or a musical performance live.
Yeah.
Is different than taped and vice versa.
Sure. Well, and the weird third gray area of when you film a stage play, why isn't that the same as filming a movie? Like, why isn't it just the same thing?
Sure.
And you see that in this. I think about that so much watching this, is I'm like, why is this not like, what is it about this? Is it literally just that where there's a fourth wall here? Why?
It's like a deconstruction through absence.
Yeah.
It's a very strange way to, you know, by the elements of it that are the least about filmmaking tell us the most about filmmaking.
Absolutely.
Which is such a just truly bizarre thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be done by David Lynch also just makes it, you know, he's a filmmaker that is incredibly cinematic in the sense that he's using all of these elements of cinema and doing them in ways that other people don't. And so when you start a deconstruction, or you start pulling out some of those elements, or I guess going, how do we make this very Lynchian without
a red lamp?
Yeah, right. Well, without lighting it like cinema, or to watch it is really to get a study of that. So I don't want to rehash all of it, but just in the things that still look and feel like David Lynch and the things that don't, and then how those are being accomplished differently, given that it's all on pretty much a single stage.
Sure.
A single just hellish fucking three-story steam tower. I don't know where the fuck, industrial park, this whole crazy, I have no idea what the fuck this set is. It's the nuttiest thing. But just his ability to still create nightmarish imagery.
Right. Oh my God, there's some of the scariest shit in this movie.
I know.
It's so fucking scary.
Which you would think, okay, well, Lynch is a filmmaker making nightmarish cinema. That has to be in part due to the way he knows how to use the tools of cinema. And when he removes himself from that, removes those those very tools, I guess, and still himself is in that. When he can't lead the camera in a certain way, weave it in a certain way, or do a certain thing, and somehow still manages to make that hellishness, that nightmarishness, and it still feels very much like him.
Yeah.
God, is that an interesting thing. It tells you so much about an artist to go like, that's still a Lynch scare.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not doing any of the stuff Lynch can normally do because he's a filmmaker and does film stuff. So, you know, like camera movement can't be the thing that does it. And what you're left with when you're looking at these kind of like, about halfway through, there's that interruption of this sort of peaceful, somber.
Yes.
Music number.
It's fucking scary.
Terrifying. Like the woman falls to the ground.
Yeah.
In this screeching nightmare, and then she's like a 20-foot tall antler beast made of meat kind of emerging from the... Anyways, so good is my point, I guess.
David Lynch is one of the Cecil B. DeMille directors. So is Kenneth Anger, but this is probably, outside of a Hail Mary and an AC episode, going to be the only chance we have to cover Kenneth Anger on the show, because this is his longest movie by a long shot.
Depends how weird we want to get.
So
half of me goes, this is the first of what will be many Kenneth Anger films, so I don't know.
So I've seen everything he's done.
Oh, you had about 40 minutes to spare, huh?
I know. Yeah. No, that's I've seen
ooh, short film jokes instead of long film jokes. This is a new era of double feature.
And one of the things that I really want to dive into when we're talking about a filmmaker like Kenneth Anger is how you gauge the successes and failures of experimental film and how much your audience matters anymore. Seriously, you know, like, it's definitely hard to argue that this was made to be shown in a theater. It takes you and I so far out of our comfort zone for a discussion, because this movie was clearly not meant for a theater. Was it meant to be projected in an art gallery? If so, were you supposed to sit and watch the whole thing?
Does it play on a loop?
Yeah, like how many
and what kind of drug should you have?
Sure. And it's only complicated by the fact that fucking Bobby Beausoleil did the music before he went and stabbed Sharon Tate to death.
The music, by the way, which is the entire audio track of the film.
Yeah, and it's awesome. It's super good.
Yeah, recorded or designed sound. It is all just music.
But you look at something like Lucifer Rising, and largely you look at Kenneth Anger's entire catalog, and you realize different things become important when things shift. Things like titles become outrageously informative, like paintings. You know, when you have a painting and you look at it and it's just white, you go, what the fuck am I looking at? And then you read it and it says absence of man, and you go, oh
yeah. That's a really good one. such a perfect image. Well, also in considering, I mean, God, man, one of the best fucking things you could do to learn more about the form is learn about what's missing.
Yeah.
Learn about what makes a fucking book different than a movie, what makes a graphic novel different than a book, and how do the new additional pieces of the medium add or often subtract from what you can do and how effectively you can do it. And aside from that, there is also the artifice of creating films within a system where it takes a lot of money and there are financial things to think about or entertainment factors. So like you mentioned, the title of a movie. Title of a movie could be, or the title of a piece.
Could be Industrial Symphony Number 1.
It could be there to add an additional context that informs the very, you know, what the fucking piece is even about. Mm-hmm. If it were absent, the piece would not exist. The piece would not do what it needs to. It is the B to the piece's A, and it needs to be there.
Yep.
Or it could be the title of the main character, because we're going to put him really big on the poster, and Will Smith sells big in China.
Right.
And just like the fact that movies are multi-million dollar properties and all of these different considerations go into them, it's so weird that you can't reliably, I mean, that's one of the most exciting things about movies to me, but you can't reliably go back and go, title's important. What's the title tell? I can't just watch a movie and go, oh, Mulholland Drive's hard to figure out. Well, I know that that drive is important because it's the title of the, like, you don't right. fucking know.
Sure.
Might just be where the film opens and they thought that was the most like mystical fucking sounding. Mm-hmm. I mean, you never have any idea. So with something like a painting, it's literally either the title's important or it's untitled. It is almost right. the A and B.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's other things you could do with that too, or you could simply just create a title for it or whatever. But you take my point that you're dealing with something so basic that even the title itself
is like outrageously informative. It's important.
So much.
It's valuable.
So much.
I mean, when you're dealing with this movie, Lucifer Rising, and you're watching it, you just have to watch it. What's so vastly interesting to me is from a one man, one vision perspective, that becomes so paramount when you're watching it. And two, you have to look at everything as intentional. And then when you're watching a Kenneth Anger movie, that is the most resonant factor in everything he does, is it's just constantly like all the motions, all the human movement is so deliberate. You know, things like raising your staff three times in exactly the same motion.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, you just watch and you go, man, I don't know for sure what or if that is important, but it is definitely on purpose.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I think it's easy to write off a Kenneth Anger type filmmaker as, you know, indulgent garbage. I think that's the tightrope of experimental cinema, is indulgent garbage. And it's a pitfall that you and I were definitely prey to at the beginning of this show regarding the other filmmaker on the show today.
Sure.
And I think that...
This isn't like one of those David Lynch movies that's about fucking nothing but pretends right. it is.
Exactly. I feel like
we figured that one out pretty quick though.
Well,
that didn't take 10 years to figure out. We were like, oh, whoops.
You can attest to this, cause this is like the third or fourth time I've seen Lucifer Rising, but did you watch it and at any point go, this is not about anything?
No.
Yeah.
No, I mean, well, you don't do something that hard.
Yeah. Just right?
If you're going to make a movie not about something, you don't put that much fucking detail and focus. And I mean, I guess this is an interesting question. How do you know when you're watching a movie? And certainly you don't have to know, but if you were to sit and think about which point should I be preoccupied with, let's just say you want to get the most out of the idea. You're really showing up to play by the film's rules and you're going, what does this film want to tell me? What are the themes? What can I chew on? You know, it wants to have a conversation with me and I'm going to show up and try and have the best one. Maybe only two people on a show once a week ever think that way, but I think that's a great way to think. So how do you know which elements to become preoccupied with, to go, okay, well, let's really, if you're going to have a conversation with the filmmaker immediately after the film, and you, I know, my heart just skipped a beat. I was just like, oh, please don't make me do that. You're going to go, Kenneth Anger, what was your budget and what camera did you shoot on? No, you're not going to. Don't do that. Don't do that to Kenneth Anger. He's 90. He'll kick you off his fucking lawn. I think he's still alive, right?
I think I'm pretty sure he's alive. Yeah.
Why isn't he on the show? Can we, Samuel Zimmerman, can you please get Kenneth Anger on the show?
Do you think we could have, what conversation do you think? It can't be less coherent than Jeremy Kasdan.
Jeremy likes to pop on my Facebook once a while and answer our questions.
Yeah.
So I think that's,
I saw that.
Yeah, we just summon him. There's like a button to summon Jeremy Kasdan.
There's a red materia for Jeremy Kasdan.
Yeah. There isn't one for Kenneth Anger, I don't think.
No.
So I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. Certainly you could look at, well, what does the film spend the most time doing? You could look at something like a title is, you know, a really easy indication for that. But that's something that sort of the format, and like you said, that idea of this hanging on a wall somewhere as I walk by it really made me think about.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of looking at films the way people do historic paintings.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that I really wish today's film-going culture would embrace more instead of the evaluation of did the movie do the things that you would have done right. if you were the person who made the movie or not.
I didn't like the jokes.
Was the movie right or not?
Yeah.
Or did the movie reinforce your own values and baggage that mm-hmm. you fucking brought? But, you know, no one goes into a museum or anywhere that there is historical paintings, let's say, and walks up to them and goes like, this one kind of sucks, huh? This one's could yeah. have been better. This one was sort of a failure. Here's why this six reasons this painting failed. Like nobody's...
Four will surprise you.
Yeah, right. Back to them listicles there. Yeah, nobody's really doing that. And I think the more modern the art gets, the more of a tendency there is to do that, which sure. is an interesting thing in itself that yeah. we don't have to approach at the moment, but to think about. But this movie really goes like, okay, so this movie's hanging up somewhere, huh? You walk by it, then what do? And I think, and I don't know if you have the same reaction or if this is universal, but when I go see something like a historical art piece, I immediately go, what the fuck is this? What's yeah. he trying to do? Like, mm-hmm. what's going on here? Yep. I feel put on the spot. I'm like, yeah. oh God, I hope nobody tries to talk to me about this. I don't know everything that's going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, and I think too, back that kind of goes back to inform that one question is like, what is your audience? Does your audience matter? Is your success or failure measured by your audience's reaction? Or have you elevated yourself to a level of pretentiousness? I'm going to just be straightforward.
sure,
where
sure, that's fine.
Your audience doesn't matter and you succeed simply by the fact that people watch it and then turn to somebody else and go, huh? And then yeah, you yeah. have to start. I think that with Kenneth Anger and with Lucifer Rising, I think the compulsory human nature to attempt to unpack it right off the bat is its biggest success. It's tapped into that thing that sure. forces you to ask questions. Uh-huh. It's something that a narrative film, by the very nature of what you're saying, by reinforcing your own opinions, by existing in a place you're comfortable, by having faces you recognize, by not being scored by murderers, like all of these things. That's honestly, I think the worst thing that could have happened to this movie is Bobby Beausoleil being a murderer, because I'm afraid it'll go down in history as that movie The Murderer scored.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think, and it's not just Lucifer Rising. It's a lot of Kenneth Anger's back catalog. You watch
it.
It
goes down in history, though.
Sure.
It's an important
sure,
part
that's
of
true.
Being an art piece. That might be one of the ways an art piece can fail if we do
that's
think
true.
About that.
I think that he has an uncanny ability to, first off, similar to David Lynch, give you a series of images that put your head in the right space, the place he wants you to be thinking, and then leaves you in a place where you go, okay, I have to talk about this because I'm not 100% sure I get it.
Yeah, right.
And getting it or not getting it is largely unimportant, I think. I think the fact is that you're given just enough information to have a conversation that is relevant somewhere between the title and the volcano and the Egyptian imagery and the sun and all this, you know, hot desert stuff that they're just throwing at you. I mean, it almost feels like Clockwork Orange when I watch Kenneth Anger stuff. You know, or maybe to go, or maybe The Ring, like we were talking about.
Oh, you mean within the, yeah.
Where it just,
you're talking about that film yeah. in Clockwork Orange.
Yeah,
totally.
Where I just feel like, oh my God. And my eyes are like stuck right, open right. and it's just okay. happening to me. And yeah. I'm like, okay, this is a series of, okay. And you just start having, I mean, like almost an actual visceral reaction, partially for you and I, that's because of our immediate discomfort that we're too dumb, but like,
right. Oh no, I have to talk yeah. about this.
But I think tapping into that thing in the human mind that wants to know what a thing is.
Yeah.
It's a hard question to evoke. I mean, that both of the filmmakers on the show today have nailed some bizarre human psychological experiment wherein one can go, I want you to feel this way, and now you feel that way. And another person can go, you're about to have a conversation about this. It's almost a fucking magic trick. You know, yeah, it's like cold reading, right. Except it works almost ubiquitously and you get to make a movie.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, when I look at the purpose of a film, or I guess the success or failure, you know, after us having done this show for so long, one of the longest guiding principles and the things that's kind of made the show easy to do is, or definitely has put us, I guess I should say, made it easy to say nice things about movies, mm-hmm. is, hey, these movies all got made.
Yep.
Or, except Sleepaway Camp 4, which actually did later get made, so we don't even have that one anymore. Have we talked about any movies that didn't get made at this point? That was my go-to on the one.
I mean, the next closest thing right now is Poughkeepsie Tapes, but it did get made. It just never came out.
I think that's coming out though, isn't
it?
Yeah,
no, I know, sure. Yeah, it's been coming out for the last 10 years.
I know, but I think it's like...
If they were fucking smart enough at this point with the way...
They would London After Midnight that film?
No, it would just come out on fucking VHS.
Oh, no, I think you'd light it on fire.
Yeah.
I think at this point, you go, well, some people have seen this, now fire. I think, you know, anything we've watched on the show has been a success in at least it got made, which is so ridiculously hard and often involves jumping through these convoluted hoops like we were talking about with the title, where just the not even the business of filmmaking, but just film as a medium is such a weird, complicated, difficult thing that has all of these arbitrary rules about it. Just kind of because of how it's been done and the systems around it and the sort of internal politics and mechanisms and a lot of what it takes to make a film. And what's great about experimental film is it very often seeks to destroy those things. I was surprised at first that Kenneth Anger had not made anything feature length. And then after watching Industrial Symphony Number 1, it became so obvious, you know, Lynch has been in that same place for a long time, where he just basically swore off filmmaking, said, fuck this, and until Twin Peaks, which by the way, he directed all of, that's insane that he directed all of a TV show that's, oh God, that is the caliber of just nuts. But David Lynch basically refused to direct movies for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess still to this point, and has done shorts instead. And I mean, I fucking get it. Like you don't have to jump through the hoops and your form is free again. And you can just like take the brush to the canvas. Experimental film, to do a Kenneth Anger experiment, right away, if it's a feature film, it has to be an hour and a half. So automatically, that's why we, you know, if you want to play in that arena, if you want your movie to show in places that movies show and be sold where movies are shown and wind up on lists that movies go on, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to be part of a movie conversation, you need a product that's an hour and a half. If the experiment you're running does not take an hour and a half, well, then you're not part of the conversation. We just all decided that's not a movie then. Fuck you. Go home.
Yeah.
Which is why it took 500 episodes to watch a Kenneth Anger movie.
Well, which is also funny because the other person on the other end of the spectrum is Andy Warhol, who makes a 6-hour movie. People go, that's too long. And he cuts it in half, places it side by side and goes, how about now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's another conversation about form and kind of fitting in a box. And it's so funny that, you know, we beg for these movies that are outside the box and there's nothing original under the sun and all of this crazy stuff people say. And then we go, well, what about this 20-minute movie? And you go, well, hold on. No, that's not even, that's
that
not
doesn't
a film
have
at all.
Kevin Hart in it.
Yeah. right. Yeah. As soon as you can't say what was the box office overseas, you know, the fucking foreign and domestic numbers and did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then it's like, well, we're not playing the same game anymore.
I want to talk about that. That's one question, but let's talk about the answer to the question. This is one of the things I was most excited to get to on today's show is what is the answer to the ever present question? You go, oh, I watched this movie last night called Lucifer Rising. Oh, how was it? Oh, that's not a relevant question.
You are wrong.
Yeah.
How was it? You're incorrect.
Yeah. Right? Like that's not, it exists.
You just want a buzzer. Like,
yeah, it exists in a plane. That's like, no, that's the wrong question. Sorry. Try again. Anything else you want to know? Cause that doesn't happen, you know?
Sure. Sure.
Like I got a nice candle last night. How does it taste? What?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Well, so we have one measure of success being, does the thing even fucking get done?
Yeah.
That seems like, sure. That seems like that's a pretty basic.
That's our favorite one.
Although, honestly, man, I'm also at a point where maybe that doesn't even have to happen. I'm pretty open-minded. Like, shoot me an argument why it doesn't even have to fucking leave your consciousness to be a good film. But okay, so it gets made. So when there's a big success. And then do people see it? That's a close second.
Sure, sure.
And that's especially like, that's just some like personal baggage stuff. But you and I have been making little fucking film things for 10 years and nobody's seen them.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't even exist. They're like not even real. So the idea of like, oh, well, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. Also, people have to like fucking see these things. That's a close second. And then after that, I think, are people having the conversation you intended?
Sure.
Now we're far past the point where I would really say these are checkboxes.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure at the point of an audience has to see it. Do we say pass or failed, was successful or not?
Mm-hmm.
But if we were to create sort of this granular system where there's just sort of like a gradient of success to failure, I would feel the most personally satisfied if people were having the conversations that I wanted to start.
Mm-hmm.
Or bringing up some of the points that I wanted to bring up. The idea of convincing anybody or showing them my way of thinking is like, that's totally just beyond, that's another universe. That's like,
mm-hmm.
That'll never even fuck it. If that happens, it's an accident. But did it bring up some of those subjects? So the question with Kenneth Anger then is, does it exist at the level, is he standing back and going, these people are talking about the things I wanted.
Right.
Or is he just splatting the colors and seeing what the fuck happens.
Sure.
I don't know.
I don't either.
I was really hoping you'd give me a nice bite-sized satisfying answer, but
the second one is definitely what Andy Warhol's doing, which is why of all the Cecil B. DeMented directors, I've waited to put Chelsea Girls on the show the longest, because I'm legitimately of the mind that you watch Chelsea Girls the same way you watch Yoga Hosers. And if you enjoy it, Andy Warhol is laughing at you.
Yeah, well, you know, then there's also this question about drugs, which is just a dynamic that we don't even have time to address today, but certainly plays in and may change the answers to all of the previous fucking questions.
Sure.
We have a website that is doublefeature.fm. If you add a /Shudder on there.
Ooh, you can see one of the movies next week.
You could see one, maybe both, probably not neither. Depending on how streaming services work at the moment that you're listening to this. But I guess I should say specifically for all of our international listeners, Germany, the UK, Canada, and perhaps some other places that were like, hey, I see you're giving away some free Shudder for all these people listening to your show, but my country was denied. What the fuck is up with that? Any other show would just shrug and go like, I don't know how these things work, terms and conditions apply. No, not Double Feature. Double Feature said, all right, three more countries, we'll add you. So I don't know if that's working or not, actually, to be honest with you, but try it. .shudder.com. Doublefeature.fm/shudder. Use that link. See if you can sign up. We talked to them about expanding this out to other places. And I think they did it. I hope they did it. Mm-hmm. Are you listening, Shudder? I hope you did it. Also, a big thanks to the Patreon support. We'll get back to the Shudder. Don't you worry. But a big thanks to the Patreon supporters who make this show happen, especially our executive producers on there. Mark Abbott, Ross Mahler, Jordan Sells, David Anderson, Charles Crawford, Ben Ecker, Aaron Shore, an Abbot of Unreason. Yes, that's right. Once again, back. Abbot of Unreason. All who put in money along with a bunch of other great folks. You can do that at patreon.com/doublefeature. It's the only reason we have made it this far. And it's always a big source of stress trying to do anything fucking independent, film or podcast or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And look, somehow we've survived with Patreon. I'm surprised. but glad was the word I wanted. Mm-hmm. Glad is, yes. Thanks for that, guys. So back to the Shudder thing. What, yeah. We got a Shudder movie next time?
Yeah, next time. Here? So sorry about this today. Anybody who was confused by these two movies, we're going to make it easy on you. We're going to do Mayhem and Brawl in Cell Block 99. Next week, okay?
Fuck yeah.
So there, it's going to be bloody, it's going to be violent, there's going to be punching, there's going to be directors we know and love.
And this is, Mayhem is, I'll have to check actually about Cell Block, but I can definitely say that Mayhem is the Shudder exclusive super big Shudder movie of the right now.
Cool.
But congrats, Joe Lynch, on Mayhem being the super amazing Shudder movie. 31 beat you to it, of course. But that's going to happen next time. Get on Shudder and fucking watch this. That plus one, that yeah, Shudder-like number on there.
Watch more fucking film.
And goodbye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.